This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru.
Hey guys, this is Christina on location at the Venice Film Festival, and I'm so excited to meet up with the great John Bleasdale, journalist and critic, for part two of our 2021 Venice Film Festival Dispatch. But first, a quick note. We're reviewing and agreeing and disagreeing on a bunch of movies that we've seen here, and we get into a lot of detail, so you've been warned. Enjoy! Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential from Venice with John Bleasdale. We're here, we're meeting each other for the first time.
First time, it's lovely to be here in the flesh.
Zoom does not do you justice.
You get the whole 360 degree experience. It's virtual reality, except it's reality.
So we're sitting, if you guys are going to be hearing, we're sitting in the courtyard of a hotel. Tell us where we are for the noises.
So this is a famous hotel. It was featured in a Mike Figgis film called Hotel, actually.
But, easy to remember.
yeah, easy name. The hotel's called the Ausonia, I think. He says, checking, yes, the Ausonia Palace Hotel. And it's a historical, got a beautiful facade. Really, really, really,
really beautiful.
Lovely.
Gold and...
And we're about a 10-minute walk from the festival, the film festival village. And it's really nice to be here.
So you're going to hear some mopeds and you're going to hear a fountain and little things like that. So, but you know that we're live. So how's the festival been treating you?
It's been treating me very well. Last time we spoke, we talked about the COVID things and how it went last year. I don't think it's going quite that well in terms of the organization. But that has to be put in the context of last year, a lot of people didn't come. This year we're back to almost normal attendance, I would say. Maybe a few, a number is missing because of the Americans not being here in force. So things like the booking system has been a little bit wonky, and some of the security measures have slowed things down and delayed people getting to screenings. But I personally, I can't complain. I've had a really good time so far.
Yeah, I've had a very good time too. It has been difficult to, you've had to take quite some time to book because you've had to book 72 hours before each film. And so sometimes when you're sitting in a film, you can't book another film and things like that. So, and there's nothing to complain about other than some things you have to cover. So for work, it makes it a little bit difficult.
But, absolutely.
We're here and we've seen a lot of great movies and we've seen the ones that we talked about. I think you've seen a few more because I've had a few interviews that have taken some time. So, I mean, one theme that for me and for everyone, it's not an original theme, but I think that's really stuck out in this festival.
Airplane going.
That's George Clooney coming from Cuomo. You know, but one theme that's really stuck out for me is motherhood. It's motherhood in almost every movie I've seen, from Dune with Rebecca Ferguson and Timothy Chalamet to Madres Paralelas to one that both we're going to talk about later that both of us really like, the Maggie Gyllenhaal picture, Lost Daughters. There's been so much focus on really, and of course The Power of the Dog with Kirsten Dunst and her son, which also is a very powerful thing for us. So it's been so interesting for me to really see several of them directed by women, and it's just been very powerful for me, this theme. And not to mention Spencer.
I was just about to say,
So have this, you noticed, you thinking about this as well?
Well, until you mentioned it, no.
Well, you're not a mother, you're a father, I know.
This is true. it has been very, very, very much about women, definitely. And yes, you're absolutely right. And as you were, listing them, I was jumping ahead and trying to think of another example. And of course, Spencer came immediately to mind. Motherhood is really, that's, I mean, this often happens at festivals that it's almost like a chaos theory thing that one of the defining qualities of randomness is clusters.
Yeah.
So that random doesn't mean everything is spread out evenly. It means that occasionally you're going to get heads, and then tails.
Yeah.
It might be something to do with there being a few more, but I mean, there aren't more women in competition, for instance.
No, there's
more,
less.
So I don't think that's the case, but certainly maybe, I don't know, maybe we all need nurturing in this hard time, and we're thinking about that a little bit
more.
Yeah,
I was thinking that it's sort of, as you were mentioning, it is a cluster, but it is a cluster because we've spent so much time analyzing, you know, the white man and the fatherhood and the Breaking Bad type of character of man, that this was a theme that was waiting to come, and maybe it's clustered because of other reasons or COVID or whatever, but it's something that has been less explored.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the
at least for a while.
Definitely. I think there's a sense that we don't interrogate motherhood and cultural ideas behind it enough. And what is really interesting and marvelous about almost all these films is that they really give quite daring insights and new ways of thinking about mothers, which don't run along the familiar cliched lines.
Painful and
painfully
and
honest, painful, and also
ridden.
Also yeah, and also a spectrum of possibilities. I think the Moldavar parallel mothers. I'll let you do the Spanish pronunciation of the Spanish title. Is a really good example of kind of not just looking at the old version of what a mother can be, but actually offering a really new idea of what motherhood means, both biological and non-biological.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's get into that one later, but why don't we start with the movie that I think everyone was waiting for, and that's Dune.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I really, really liked it. I really thought, I loved the look of it. I think Denis Villeneuve has this amazing sense of scale. I think the it was gorgeous. It's not Roger Deakins as a cinematographer. I forget the name of the cinematographer, but the cinematography was luscious and immense. It had a sincerity that science fiction doesn't always have. We've got very used to the sort of quipping of the Avenger movies and the comic book movies, which seem to be winking so often. It looks like a nervous tic now. Whereas this was genuinely sincere. It was taking the idea of the epic seriously, and I think that was fitting. You know, I mean, it's not humorless. There are two or three jokes, but literally two or three, and they're not at the expense of the film.
Which was the perfect amount, because Denis doesn't tend to do a lot of humor at all, and he had a little bit, but not that you're tipping over to what you're talking about, that Marvel where you're like a mile a minute, there's someone coming
in. Yeah, absolutely, the wisecracking patter of Deadpool or Robert Downey Jr. In Iron Man. I mean, a lot of those Marvel films feel to me like they're revivals of old screwball comedies. I'm not sure if that comparison will stand much attention, but still. Whereas this was anti-camp science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also interesting because Herbert, if you know the book, Herbert invents a very interesting sort of mixture of myth and fantasy and history into science fiction. I mean, he's not doing the technologically advanced sort of things. It's basically, what if you take the Middle Ages and you give them spaceships?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a political organization is feudal. They're big noble families who have the power, and there's an imperium above them. And their relationships to the indigenous people of the families is of the planets is also extremely exploitative. So in the film, there are these really serious subtexts of political criticism of imperialism, criticism of environmental destruction, mm-hmm. and exploitation. And on top of all of that, you also have this hero's journey, which is very familiar from The Matrix and from Star Wars, of somebody being the chosen one, somebody being the person who's going to make a difference.
And visually, just very beautiful, evocative picture, thinking of Afghanistan. It just evoked a lot of thoughts about what's happening right now, just in the visuals.
Absolutely. I mean, all the Middle East, I think, comes into this picture. There's a sort of bits of it that reminded me of the first Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
and Werner Herzog's Lessons of Darkness, where he photographed the burning of the oil fields in Kuwait. It also reminded me of Saddam Hussein's palaces, the sort of this grand but empty splendor. The music is at times
a little overpowering.
But it also is, you know, goes with the tone of sort of epic, not seriousness, but importance. This has got heft. This has got weight. The one reservation I have is that this is part one. The credit at the very beginning of the movie is Dune part one. And the very end of the movie, it finds an ending, although it takes a while, does slightly struggle towards the end to actually find it. It leaves it open. I mean, there's no way this can... I don't think this film stands alone. Mm. I think it needs a sequel. It needs to be completed.
Yeah.
It's the first half of a book that was not published
in two
halves.
But I think it was quite clear with that, though. I mean, there's a text in the beginning, and feels like it. So, because one thing I thought was interesting and a little bit odd is that the critics that didn't really like it, the first critics that came out, thought it was too grand and pretentious and serious. And I was like, well, what did they want? Did they want Deadpool? It just felt like that criticism was...
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go and have a huge sort of banquet, you know, you can't...
Well, they wanted Lynch.
Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, I'm a really big fan of the Lynch film, and I know it doesn't work narratively. In the same struggle that this film is going to have to get the second half completed. Mm. But I think that criticism is like, you know, you're going to a banquet in a medieval palace and you're complaining about the portions.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, the portions are too big. You know, you go to your salad bar, but this is, you have to accept a film on its own generic frame. If it's doing something very specific. If you don't like anything that does that thing, then you can't just criticize this one individual film.
Right.
I mean, you know, other opinions are available, and I'm sure there will be some very eloquent sort of takedowns of the movie. I just worked for me. Mm-hmm. I sat there as both a fan of the book, but also someone who loves cinema and science fiction in particular. And it satisfied me on a lot of different levels.
Yeah. And the cast is really good. I really enjoyed the cast. From the smaller parts, Stellan Skarsgård is great as the Baron. Hugely
Charlotte
in
Rampling
makeup.
Has
Charlotte Rampling is all in, you can hardly see her, and she's there, in two scenes or scene and a half or something like that?
Yeah, but it's hugely effective.
Yeah, hugely effective. And Timothée Chalamet is great in this. He really works as the sort of... the boy prince, or whatever you call him.
He's kind of sexy Hamlet,
great
isn't
hair. The hair is just a character of its own. And the one who I thought was best was really Rebecca Ferguson, who plays his mother. And there you have the mother son relationship, which I thought that they handled really well throughout. And I was quite affected by it, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's slightly sort of like an unconventional thing as well, because she's the concubine rather than the wife of the Duke, because he needs to stay single so he can marry for political purposes. So she has a definite subservient position, but she's also belongs to this religious order called the Bene Gesserit, and they sort of like almost like Catholic nuns, but they foster this telepathic powers and this bloodline, and they can use these powers with their voices to influence people and everything. So she's also this extremely powerful figure in his life, and in some ways she's
the
much more
powerful. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. She turns out to, you know, I mean, we use the phrase soft power sometimes, and then she has a very hard version of that, you know, in influencing the people around her. So I think that was a very interesting role. Mm. I'll be interested to see, because the book was written in 1965, and some of the concepts are definitely open to criticism. The idea of the white savior going into an indigenous population and leading it to a political thing. And the book was influenced by T.E. Lawrence and the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, so it kind of unavoidable that template. But I do feel that Villeneuve and his screenwriters are really updating it and finding resonance with today's, as you mentioned, Afghanistan, the environmental issues, which are every day more and more present. So, yeah, and I'm really looking, I really hope they make part two. I don't think it's a done deal at all.
No, Oscar Isaac is also very good. He's in three different projects, so we can leave him to talk about coming up. He's the sort of MVP of the festival. He's magnetic in everything he does, as you mentioned. But let's move on to another couple of maestros that we talked about on the last one, and that's Sorrentino and Almodovar, which we both have seen. They're sort of the big European auteurs coming with their big movies here, and I think perhaps we'll be finding it out over Best Foreign Picture come Oscar, the Oscar race. What do you think, Sorrentino?
Well, I don't think Sorrentino will be competing for the Oscar. I mean, maybe nominated, but I don't think that he would win that. I mean, I'm terrible at predicting these things, so by all means, play this back next year. The Hand of God is very, as we said in the first part, the first episode, is a very personal, autobiographical thing about a personal tragedy. And so I kind of went into this feeling very, very sympathetic towards the subject matter and wanted to see it. But unfortunately for me, Sorrentino is just whatever the Italian version of Marmite is. It just doesn't do it for me. And so even when he's good, and this film is much better than Loro and it's much better than Youth, it's still, I still can't quite, I don't have a taste for the grotesquerie of his comedy. I find his sentiment, his emotional, sentimental. The ghost of Fellini hovers, you know, it's like that film Yesterday, where the Beatles music disappears overnight and only one person can remember it.
Right.
You know, imagine a version of Yesterday where it's Fellini's cinema disappears and
Sorrentino is
the only person who remembers vaguely watching the films, and he's reproducing them. And that's kind of his career, I feel. This is definitely an improvement on his last two movies. But I just felt he was. It's a lot of kind of bad taste. Mm-hmm. I don't fit in with his sensibility. Loads of people loved it. The screening I was at, there was a long applause, there was cheering. I think it really appeals to Italians, because he does get Napoli, you know, they recognize in him an accurate version. But it didn't do it for me, I'm afraid. And it had like five different endings. Dune couldn't find an ending. It should have borrowed one.
Yeah, you could take one from Sorrentino.
Oh, he wouldn't have missed it. He'd still have four.
Yeah. Now, I'm a bit more forgiving, because I thought that the story of his parents and the characters of the parents, I really liked that, and it affected me. And for those who didn't listen, I mean, there's a very tragic thing that happened to Sorrentino when he was 17 and to his parents, but he was saved because he went to a Maradona game while this was happening. That was very effective. For me, what didn't work was the incredibly cliched women that he has in this movie. The very typical Italian, the young 16, 17-year-old has to have his sexual awakening by an older woman who so gratuitously gives himself to him for help, and this felt very cliche, and a lot of busty women. But I felt that there was a lot of the boy who portrayed him, who also looks like Timothy Chalamet with
very
great hair,
so.
But who is Sorrentino? His, you know, in this picture, it was. I would have loved even more. The ending was of how cinema saved him. Was much shorter than I thought it would be. I thought that would be more of a part of the movie. They spent more time on the other part. So that was like a mixed bag for me. But I thought that his family, the parents, I understand what you're saying, that there's cliches there too, but that was more effective for me.
Yeah, I agree with you, it is lopsided. And again, I was looking at it and thinking of Nuovo Cinema Paradiso, the Tornatore film.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of his view of women, he always has this rather leering adolescent view of women anyway. You could almost forgive it in this film if you say, well, the film is shot from the perspective of a 17-year-old boy, so it's his point of view. But Sorrentino has this in all of his films. So he's, you know, he likes female flesh. Yeah, absolutely. And the mum, I guess, would be, because all of these people,
yeah, that's
he's
why
related
she was so
to.
Good.
There's a sort of an incestuousness about it. that you know, his sexual fantasy is with his aunt.
Yeah.
You know, that he loses his virginity to a woman who's essentially a kind of like grandmother figure to him, not biologically, but still.
Mm. It's been in his whole life.
Yeah. Exactly. But I mean, even when it was at its strength, which I think his family.
Yeah, the parents and the mother,
parents
very much
and the relationship
so.
With the parents, that was where it was at its strongest. But even there, I found myself thinking of Amarcord and Fellini and just thinking, oh man, 10 minutes in Fellini's kitchen is worth, you know, yeah. 3 hours in sort of Sorrentino's whole apartment. You know? So yeah, it didn't work for me, I'm afraid.
Well, it worked more for me, I thought it was, but I understand your point. And then Madres Paralelas, which is Almodóvar's movie starring Penelope Cruz, who I think is just a national and international treasure. She's really great in this movie.
And she's in two films in this competition as well, official competition, which I've just seen.
Oh yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, I haven't seen that, we'll say afterwards. But it's basically about two single mothers, one younger than her, who meet in the maternity ward as they're just about to have a baby, and then their lives become parallel in a sense because of these children that they have. And it's also mixed with a lot of things about family, about going back in your family and who you belong to, and blended families and what does it mean. And I thought it just worked so well for me. I thought it was the perfect amount of the Almodóvar that you want, with the actors, with the colors, with the humor, and then something new that I did not see several of the twists and turns coming in this movie, which I know a lot of people feel are a bit crazy because it takes a few twists and turns that you read, but I did not see them coming, and that really worked for me.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. I'm not a huge fan of Almodóvar, and I always enjoy his films, and I always think there's a consistent quality. They're always interesting, but it's not a filmmaker I particularly anticipate a new film coming out. This was one of his best in my book. I really, really enjoyed it, and maybe it's because there was a maturity, there was a sort of gracefulness about the filmmaking that really suited the subject matter, because the subject matter as well has this sort of daytime soap opera plot that could easily have gone into that territory, but he pulls it back and he relates it very much to Spanish history, and there's a real depth to his vision. I think there's a real thoughtfulness in this film that sometimes he lacks, so sometimes it's kind of the fun of his films as well. There's a vim and a sort of love of superficiality which is totally intentional, but here I felt There's a bit at the beginning and then at the end where they go into exploring Spain's fascist past, and it kind of is also a way of indicating perhaps a potential Spanish future, which if it does come to pass, and hopefully it will, Almodóvar would actually be one of the unacknowledged architect.
Oh, absolutely. I thought he so beautifully moved from that very deep and difficult theme of, you know, Spain's fascist history to this superficiality that he does. And now we have to talk about Spencer, which I guess is one of the most talked about movies this festival, which is, of course, Pablo Larraín's movie about the Christmas days leading up to Diana's decision to divorce Charles. And it's Kristen Stewart who plays Diana, and it's gotten rave reviews. She's gotten rave reviews. I'm mixed, but I'll let's listen to you first. Or I can start, but you can start.
Setting me up to fail. So that I'll... Well, the reason it's really, really talked about, let's face it, is because of Kristen Stewart. And she has a sort of fame and celebrity which extends way beyond her film career. In fact, you know, she's releasing quite a number of films which are not necessarily sort of bothering the multiplexes in terms of making huge numbers. I mean, I think they're doing okay, but you know, films like Seaburg, Camp X-Ray,
Personal Shopper,
Underwater just came out recently. I'm not sure what I've not looked at the box office, but they're not, you know, there's not hit after hit in there. Certainly not smash hits, but her persona and her sort of even her public sort of celebrity is much, much bigger than her career as an actress, I think. And that makes her choice for Princess Diana really interesting, because ultimately she's a very famous person with an ambivalent relationship to her fame, playing a very famous woman with an ambivalent mm-hmm. relationship to fame. And I think it really works. There's a very first scene that she appears in. Her accent just doesn't feel quite right. It feels much more like an impersonation than it does a performance. And she looks much more like Naomi Watts in Diana than she looks like Diana. So that at the very beginning, I was sort of thinking, uh-oh, this could be another, well, Naomi Watts in Diana. It could be one of those, let's hope it's really bad so we can enjoy it for how bad it is. But after that first scene, I was reeled in quite quickly, and I found her very good. I thought her performance was really fragile, suggested a fragility, but also a resilience. It suggested a mischievousness to her, her chronic tardiness, for instance, there was an element of rebellion in there. And also, and this is, I think, where it adds something very new to the story, it really does suggest that Diana was having pretty serious mental health mm-hmm. problems.
Yeah, that's the first time you see, because we've had a lot of Dianas, particularly those who followed the Crown. There's going to be more Diana with even a third actress. First it was Emma Corrin, and then now Kristen, and then Elizabeth Debicki is going to play her in another season of. But this is the first time I actually see a director going to a place where she actually has, you know, we're actually showing mental health issues and not just being totally tortured by her loveless marriage and what happened to her and not being able to get out of the royal family. And it suggests a little bit more. I thought that was very interesting too.
Pablo Larraín, the director, and Stephen Knight, who's a screenwriter, they make this very explicit by playing with time, by cutting out things which were led up to, you know, it builds up a meal, for instance, and then it'll cut to dessert, or it'll cut to Diana in the bathroom. And it's very disconcerting how it does that. There are also visions and a ghost appearance by Anne Boleyn. That I found...
did not work for me. No, that was the part that didn't work for me.
Less successful, certainly, and a little bit too on the nose as far as a comparison was concerned. But it did escape the Crown, you know, because the Crown, we know all this. We know that she had an eating disorder. We know that she was being in a loveless marriage with a fairly cold man, a cruel man at times. But the thing that Pablo Larraín does is he focuses entirely on her, on Kristen Stewart's performance, and he eliminates the rest of the royal family, who are really,
they're just sort of in the background.
Exactly.
You just see, you recognize there's a redhead that's probably Ferg and things like that, but
sure.
They very little, they don't talk.
And there's no interaction.
Right.
The only members of the royal family, the most significant ones that she has a relationship with, are her sons, William and Harry. And I thought every scene with those actors, those child actors, were amazing.
They were marvelous.
And every scene that they had together, it's Clooney going back.
Yeah.
Every scene that they had together.
He's bringing Brad Pitt.
Yeah, every scene they had together, I thought elevated also Kristen Stewart's performance, because there's something essentially girlish about Diana as well. There's something that she's refusing to grow up, she's refusing to conform, she's refusing to settle down into this sort of princess role, which needs to be sort of not playful, and with her children she can be playful, she can be loving, and she ultimately finds her only happiness there.
Stunningly well cast. I wasn't sure I would think that. The disappointment for me, because I agree with you with all the things, and the cinematography was spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
Another
Claire
female
LaPont.
DP, yeah. Just amazing, and all the scenes with the food coming in and the kitchen, it was just, you know, you were just them. With Jackie, Pablo Larraín's previous film about a woman trapped under the pressures of media and in the Camelot, as Jackie was, I thought that he brought a very specific own idea to her agency and what she was doing, and how she was sort of taking command of saving the media image and the Camelot and all that she did. I did not really see that he had any new idea about Diana, other than, yes, he showed how she felt. It was very surreal. It was very almost like a horror movie when she's running around the castle, and you really get the feeling of how she's held hostage and just physically ill over the whole situation and going more and more crazy. I understand that, but there was no, I missed one little more aspect of what his feelings towards who she actually was.
I'm lived through those periods. I was living in the UK at the time, and I'm very resistant to this sort of rewriting of history and the hagiography of Diana as the people's princess or the queen of our hearts or whatever. You know, she did admirable charity work, but she was a member of the nobility. I don't have much sympathy for her as a role, as a model in any way. And I do find these sort of fairy tale rewritings of her. And again, there's a weaker part of the film is she has a relationship with several members of the help, so to speak.
The downstairs.
The downstairs of the upstairs downstairs. Mm-hmm. So you have a chef who, played by Sean Harris, who seems to have an intimacy that you don't understand where it came from. And it could. There was a bit of me that was almost thinking, is he an imaginary character? Mm-hmm. Are these conversations actually happening? Because they didn't feel particularly
attached.
Well,
I think he wants you to feel that with several of them, because she even asks at one point her dresser, are you real? Is that you? At one point. So I had the feeling that he sort of wants you to feel that her... And basically what it is that Diana's trust issues, because the help would tell other members of the royal family. And so it became a paranoia, is how I felt, that he wanted to, you know, that she didn't know who, and that's why we didn't really know what was real and what was real and who wasn't, which was interesting. But I have to say about The Crown, the thing is that The Crown did not do a bad job. It was a very good season with Diana, where she actually does a lot of the things that she does here. The dancing, she feels... I mean, it's basically this story where she's trapped in the castle and she's dancing and she's roller skating. You see, so for me, I do think that it does hurt it a little bit. It hurts it a little bit because the themes, I mean, they were just done, and they were just done quite well.
I mean, it has the element where there are certain things it definitely doesn't do. Certain things it doesn't do. And one of those things, for instance, is in The Crown, they have discussions. The family has discussions.
Exactly.
She has conferences with the Queen, interviews.
She tries.
And arguments with Charles. Here, most of that is left out. And there is a sense that she's almost always talking to herself or talking to someone who she's not sure what their relationship is to her. Paranoia, I think, is a really interesting point. I think that's the key to the movie.
I think so too.
Because as the film goes on, you don't ever really understand, is she being treated really, really badly, or does she only think she's been treated really, really badly?
Which was the interesting thing, and which was sort of the brave thing to do, because he did leave us very ambiguous towards her. And it wasn't one of those, oh, they're just torturing her. You were sort of wondering once in a while, just go down and have that dinner now.
Yeah.
Just do it and then go back to your boys and leave it be and then leave, you know.
Yeah, for anything for a quiet life,
yes.
Sort of. Don't need to be always defying them, although the compulsion to be late and the compulsion not to seemed to be a compulsion rather than a voluntary act. I mean, again, there was this ambiguity between whether she was doing this on purpose or whether she was just unable to control herself. Mm. I think that and you could easily watch this film and come away thinking Prince Charles isn't that bad, you know. Mm. I don't think the royal family, I think with The Crown, you definitely become Team Diana.
Oh yeah, they're just all assholes.
They're horrible. Yeah. And she's an innocent outsider who gets caught up in the teeth of the machine. I think here it's actually much more ambivalent.
I thought it was good, but they had slightly cliche ghost appearances and things like that brought it down for me a bit.
I think it really stands or falls by that central performance. I mean, she's in almost every scene. Mm-hmm. She dominates the movie. And it's a really difficult task because she is right from the very beginning in a mess, in a crisis. So there is a danger that it can be a one-note character, that she's teary-eyed for a good 50% of the movie. Mm-hmm. And that can be grating, but I think she gives enough
Well, she did that
colour
well.
And mm-hmm. difference for it to go through and you know and feel quite a lot of sympathy for the character as well.
Yeah. So moving along to a movie that I know that we both really like was Maggie Gyllenhaal's really stunning directorial feature debut, The Lost Daughters, which is based on a Ferrante novel and starring Olivia Colman, who's just amazing in it. And you really liked it as well. It's one of my favorites that I've
seen.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you, have you read the Ferrante novel?
I have not.
Ah, okay, mm-hmm. okay. Neither have I, so we're right. I just thought.
But I do feel, because I've read the My Brilliant Friend, that I do really hear Ferrante's voice in it, in terms of, you know, the motherhood and guilt and women and
yeah.
So, and now I really want to read it because I'm really curious of how she did this so phenomenally well.
Yeah,
Maggie Gyllenhaal, who wrote it also.
Right,
the screenplay.
Right. Okay. Well, I was just so impressed by this film because as a debut, it's utterly confident, sure-footed, tonally perfect. Performances are amazing. I think when you cast Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley in a movie, you're pretty.
Jesse Buckley is the younger version of the woman that Olivia Colman plays. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Yes, because it takes place on two different time frames, essentially as an older woman played by Olivia Colman, who's on a sort of working holiday
older
on a
woman,
Greece
she's
island.
My age. No, I'm just kidding.
Older relationship to Jesse Buckley. Yeah, no, you're well. Actually, that does become a point in
it
the
does.
Movie.
Yeah.
That's a real when is old, and yeah. when is you know. She's in her 40s.
She's 48.
I was thinking there was a film by Joanna Hogg, which was about a woman going on holiday with a bunch of friends, and she's on her own. But it's about her. It's about how difficult a single, mature woman. It doesn't kind of fit in. We still don't. It's like, what are mm-hmm. you doing on your own?
Yeah,
where's your
husband?
Supposed,
yeah.
Where's your partner? Where's your, you know? And it sort of has that aspect that everybody is like, kind of, what are you doing here? That's not, in a way that they wouldn't be with a man. And on the beach, she comes into contact with this sort of American Greek family who have a young child and who she seems to be triggered by. When she first sees, and it triggers her into remembering her own experience as a young mother, played by Jessica Buckley, and looking back on the relationship she had with her two young children, which is just revealed very slowly and piece by piece, and
themes that you don't see so much about how tiring it can be to have small children and how a woman is not supposed to feel that and just so slowly all, you know, reveals how her then, if it's her husband or her boyfriend or whatever is, and how that relationship is. And then it's the young Greek American mother and then now who is played by really well by Dakota Johnson, who also has a very difficult relationship that she's sort of observing from the beach. And there's all these women in the different stages of motherhood. That just got me thinking of so many of my own stages of motherhood, and just so elegantly directed for a first-timer that it just swept me away.
Absolutely. I mean, she absolutely knows what... There was almost something a little bit like Cassavetes in where she was putting the camera. She was right up in people's
yes,
faces.
True.
Yeah, it's... there is an element of her being in Greece as well, where she's sort of the fish out of water. She's this the one person who doesn't really fit in. Where it almost felt like a horror movie as well, because this family seemed to have a bad reputation, and there are some teenage boys who are very sort of bullying and nasty. But Olivia Colman just presents this portrait of this woman who is no pushover at all. You know, she's a professor, she's achieved stuff professionally, she is very forthright, she can be quite stubborn at times, and yet she seems to be accessing a kind of traumatic period in her life mm-hmm. as well, and sort of trying not to fall apart under the pressure of it. It's such a beautiful performance.
The things that she can do with her face,
yeah,
is I don't think there's any other actor that can do that. She does the little thing she does with her mouth. She shows a little bit of disgust. You
yeah.
can see when she starts tearing up, how she's holding it back and goes for it. She really does amazing things just with looks. Because the long portion of the film in the beginning is her just observing. It's very quiet. She's observing that family. She's observing the apartment. She's looking at all kinds of things when she arrives to this apartment she's going to be alone at for a while, working. And but just because it's her and what she does with her face, you understand what she's thinking and how she's thinking, and
She has such talent. I think she's technically such a superb actress. And if you ever listen to her in an interview, she's also incredibly humble, and she'd be almost dismissive of her own talent. Mm-hmm. Says, "Oh, I don't really understand it," and yet she is the master of, like, she can evoke anything. Mm-hmm. You know, she's in this film. She's a master of this sort of embarrassed smile, mm-hmm. and trying to, and then you'll think, oh, she's a nice person, and then there's the steel in her soul that will suddenly shine through in her eyes. And she's someone who is brave enough to show the uglier side of, I don't mean physically at all, uglier side of her life, in terms of the uglier side of a character, really expose herself, and show herself in a way that is not particularly attractive. Mm-hmm. And then another instant, she can, you know, there's a scene with the Irish actor from Normal People, mm-hmm, I've forgotten the name of the guy, where he said they're getting drunk together, and he says, "Oh, you're really beautiful," and she is. Mm-hmm. She is really
gorgeous,
beautiful.
Yeah.
So, it's she can really
Paul
do
Mescal
that.
Paul Mescal is his name.
There you go. Yeah, but I mean, look, we were talking in part one of the podcast about how there are fewer women in the competition, and how we were looking at Jane Campion as, like, she could be a winner in this thing. I think Maggie Gyllenhaal has to be a contender.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I think she's turned up, and it's just so great to have another female director who is really, you know, I hope that this is the beginning of a long, fruitful career, because she's definitely got the chops.
Oh, absolutely. You know? I think so, too. Well, let's get into Power of the Dog. If you were mentioning Jane Campion, also absolutely blew me away. I know it's more of a divisive film that people either loved or didn't, it seemed like. It absolutely worked on me. I saw the character played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who's a very evil, almost cliche rancher cowboy, who basically destroys the Kirsten Dunst character, who is his brother's wife, who comes in to live with them, as more of a fable, as a creation of male patriarchy and toxic masculinity and repression and for me, it just got me thinking of all these themes. I also thought it was just gorgeous. It was in a Western milieu. She's really taken all the tropes, all the spurs that are too loud when the cowboys are walking, and the horses and this. So it blew me away. I thought it was a female perspective on genres that not many females have touched. It's almost always had women at the center, and I thought she really took an interesting perspective looking at this male character. What about you?
I think in terms of, she's always been open to generic experiment. I mean, when she did In the Cut, she was very much doing a feminist version of those erotic thrillers, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which was so popular with Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think she does the Western really well. I mean, the Western is a genre. The West is all about ending. You're always having the end of the West in the Western. You know, the railroad arrives in Once Upon a Time in the West, or John Wayne has to walk into the sunset at the end of The Searchers. Here, the West has ended for a good 10, 15, 20 years. It's 1925. Everyone, there's this ranch where Phil, the Benedict Cumberbatch character, is living as if it's the early 19th century. You mentioned his spurs earlier on. Mm. You know, he walks around the house in his spurs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he luxuriates in the sort of the filth of what he's doing. He castrates bulls without wearing gloves for no reason. You know, so there's just this sense that he's fetishizing the West.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting having a Western which has as its main character somebody who's fetishizing the very thing that makes it a Western.
Exactly. And there's all the whistle, the Morricone type of thing. I mean, there's all these things
he plays
that she's
the banjo,
using.
You know, there's a real sense that the 20th century arrived 25 years ago, and it still hasn't arrived in this ranch. And even when you meet his parents at one point, you realize, oh, well, wait a second, they're living in the 20th century. And you find out as well later on that he has actually been in civilization. He's a university graduate. And so, in a sense, he's kind of cosplaying the cowboy bit a little. Now, my problem or resistance to the film was that I felt Benedict Cumberbatch didn't quite embody that evil character. He's not a Daniel Day-Lewis in mm-hmm. There Will Be Blood, which I think is a film which is very much in conversation with this film. Having said that, it might be the case that he's playing someone playing a cowboy, and therefore, if there is a gap in credibility, it might as well, it might as much be the character's fault as it is the actor's. Mm-hmm. But I did think it was really handsome. Mm-hmm. I did think it was the landscape with the changing colours and the clouds drifting over were just superb.
Another female DP.
Right. Well, you know.
No, it worked
good.
For me. And he worked for me. And Kirsten, we were talking about brave female roles. This is not just someone who... Kirsten Dunst isn't playing a woman who's just is a little upset. She's basically become, annihilated by the end of this, the alcohol and all this. And I thought that was a powerful performance that they took all the way.
Yeah. She doesn't have any. It's in a way very degrading and humiliating for the character, and it's tough. I mean, I wondered if there was an element of her character that was almost a little bit too much like the victim not that there's anything wrong with that, but if it hadn't been an actress as good as Kirsten Dunst, I think there was a danger of sort of losing sympathy with her because she's having such a hard time of it, and there's almost no fight back. But I think she is really, really good and really, really sympathetic. It is kind of a world without women, and she is the one woman mm-hmm. in this whole thing.
And I do think that she introduces things in her background there. She had a garden, she could play the piano. She in the world without women, she was actually trying, she's a single mother who's really sure. protective of her son. So I didn't feel that she was a victim other than, comparing our time to her time.
Sure.
There was this so much that she could do, but then then you could see her being crushed in a way that I thought was quite interesting. And her husband is played by Jesse Plemons, her real life husband. They have great chemistry, of course. But
one thing I wondered about that is what would the film have been like if Jesse Plemons and Benedict Cumberbatch had swapped roles? Because Jesse Plemons is a wonderful actor, but he's in danger of being sort of given these sort of good-hearted doofus roles.
Yeah. Here he's very the repressed brother. I mean, he's also crushed by his own brother.
I think it would have been a more interesting
film. Could be, yeah.
Because I think Plemons would have been. I know Benedict Cumberbatch is to a degree playing against type, because he usually plays heroic figures, mm-hmm. but he also usually plays heroic figures who are kind of, well, to use an Italian phrase, antipathical. Mm-hmm. They're quite Sherlock or Doctor Strange are kind of nasty, arrogant people who turn into heroes.
But not to say too much about this character. I mean, he's not. I mean, he has one more level to him that you understand towards the middle of.
Sure, absolutely. That is true. There is it is a more complex character, and I think that's what the whole film does. Actually, it introduces you to people who you think are types, and then it humanizes them, and humanizes them for sort of better or worse.
And surprise, you have this one picture of who the Benedict Cumberbatch character is, and you're sort of and all of a sudden something new is introduced about his background where you're like, oh, okay, well, I didn't see that come. I mean, and she just brings that in.
That's an interesting point. Mm. She is extremely good, I think, at getting the period right, and not just in terms of the production design and the furniture and that sort of stuff, but also in terms of having characters behave the way they would behave in that period. I think she did that wonderfully with the piano, for instance, and I think she does it here as well. There's a real sense that the people exist within their times, even as they're sort of struggling in some ways to hold those times back in the terms of Benedict Cumberbatch or in the terms of his brother to actually bring them forward.
But don't you think she actually wanted an actor who we didn't know how he would surprise us? I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis, we would have known what he was bringing into this somehow. And it'd be interesting to ask her why, you know, point blank, why she chose him, because she apparently she really went after him.
And they worked worked together and you know, I mean, I think he, you know, he physically doesn't look like a cowboy.
No.
He's not thick set. He's skinny. He's a beanpole. I think that maybe also draws a comparison with Pete, Rose and George's son, Kristen Dunst and Jesse Plemons' son, who he's played by.
Well, he's not Jesse Plemons' son.
No, sorry.
He's the stepson.
Exactly, you're
he's
right.
The widow, yeah.
Yeah.
What is his name?
Kit something.
Very good, though. Sorry, we would not remember the name.
The edit, you'll just drop the name in the different voice.
I'll go next to a fountain and drop the name. It's like, no.
He's very good, but he's also very, very thin, and so there's a sort of a pairing, a sort of.
And they're more alike
reflection.
Than
and they're
the
very they're very alike. But I think we can say it. I mean, I don't think, is it a twist? Is it a spoiler? Because that's the interesting part of the film. That's the most interesting aspect of the film, is that if you don't want to hear, you
spoiler
know,
coming.
It's a queering of the West as well. In that Benedict Cumberbatch's character is definitely
a repressed
homosexual. So. I think that's and you mentioned toxic masculinity, which I think is a word which is beginning to wear out a little bit. But going back to the original idea of toxic masculinity was the fact that toxic masculinity originally was formulated as the idea of mansplaining toxic masculinity. Can you believe that?
I'm waiting for it.
Yeah. I can't. I'm not only telling you, I'm giving you myself as an example. But it was actually about masculine behaviours which damage the man, which damage inability to show affection and ability to empathise, all that rest of it. Not so much how we think of it nowadays, which is just being a shitty person or being a shitty man. And this film it has that toxic masculinity in that the character literally rolls around in mud to avoid contact with other people. I mean, he says at one point, "I like my own stink." And
don't get close to me.
Yeah, exactly. And so it is almost like a literal demonstration of that.
So you like it more now, right?
You're absolutely right.
But there's
It is a film I would definitely revisit.
Do you want to round up?
There are a couple of films I would like to mention.
Yeah.
So Official Competition, which is a comedy from an Argentinian pair of directors, and it stars Penelope Cruz and Antonio Banderas and an Argentinian actor whose name I can't remember, but we'll drop all of these in the fountain. And it's a hilarious comedy about the making of a film. With two actors who have very different philosophies, and Antonio Banderas is a Hollywood star actor, and the Argentinian guy is a more of the theatrical, teaches acting and is very intellectual about it, and it's just brilliant. It's
ooh,
just so funny.
Yeah.
It's so funny, and it's very, very brilliantly constructed little farce essentially, but with very witty, and it's great to see Banderas really having fun with his own sort of public persona. Mm-hmm. And then the other film that I'd like to finally sort of end up with is Il Buco, which is an Italian film by the same director who did Quattro Volte. Again, I'm sorry, I don't have the name at my fingertips. And the Quattro Volte was a sort of documentary set in Calabria. It's kind of a drama documentary. It's very much filming stuff happening, but it tells a narrative story. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a documentary at all. It's just a different way of filming a fiction, I guess. Long shots, both in terms of duration, but also in terms of distance, often a landscape, and then it will pick out a detail of the landscape and we'll go in and see. This film is about a bunch of cave explorers who came down from the north of Italy into Calabria to explore one of the deepest caves in the world. They didn't know it was the deepest at the time. They were exploring it, so they found that out. This story is... So that's a period thing. Mm-hmm. This story is linked to the story of a herdsman, another cowboy, if you like, a very old man up in the hills who falls ill. And these two stories take place in the same location during the same time, but are completely sort of separate. They're mm-hmm. just, and there's no dialogue in the film at all, or at least you can hear people speaking and everything, but nothing subtitles mm-hmm, in the version that I saw, and it's entirely visual and sound, and it's fantastic. It's beautiful. It has a poetry. You know, the word poetic cinema is sometimes used, and I tend to cringe when it is, but this is genuinely.
But you're going to use it.
Yeah. It's genuinely.
Oh, that's
poetry.
Nice. I want to see that. I've missed that one too.
Oh, this will make a circuit of the festival and the art cinemas. This will get shown outside of Italy, definitely.
Well, John, you have days left.
Yes.
This was the end.
Yeah.
It was so interesting to get to talk to you both in part one and part two about this.
Will there be a part three when it's all over?
That would be fun. Yeah. If you have time, I'm always there for it. Well, they'll be back on Zoom, though, so I won't get the full experience. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you, Christina. You.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.